disappeared years ago. Did you know that?
Lacey said, I saw it in a memo.
Both vanished at about the same time.
Any ideas?
Two theories. One, and the best, is that both were rubbed out not long after my conviction was affirmed. Both were career criminals. Real lizards who cleaned up nicely at trial and convinced the jury that I had bragged about the killings in jail. Well, the problem with snitches is that they often recant. So the first theory is that the real killers took out the snitches before they had the chance to change their stories. This, I believe. And the second theory?
Hugo asked.
That they were taken out by my people in revenge. I doubt this, but it's not completely far-fetched. Emotions were high, and I guess anything was possible. Regardless, the two snitches vanished and have not been seen in years. I hope they're dead. They put me here.
Lacey said, We're not supposed to be talking about your case.
It's all I have to talk about. And who really cares? This is all a matter of public record now. So that's at least four dead bodies, Hugo said. At least.
Are there more? Lacey asked. He was nodding steadily, but they couldn't tell if it was just a nervous tick or an answer in the affirmative. Finally, he said,
Depends on how hard you dig.
Chapter 6. The first courthouse built by the taxpayers of Brunswick County burned to the ground. The second one was blown away. After the hurricane in 1970, the county leaders approved a design that included a lot of brick, concrete, and steel. The result was a hideous Soviet-style hangar with three levels, few windows, and sweeping metal roofs that leaked from day one. At the time, the county, halfway between Pensacola and Tallahassee, was sparsely populated, its beaches free of sprawl and clutter. According to the 1970 census, there were 8,100 whites, 1,570 blacks, and 411 Native Americans. A few years after the new courthouse, as it was known, opened for business, the coast along the Florida Panhandle sprang to life as developers rushed to build condos and hotels. With miles of wide and untouched beaches, the Emerald Coast became an even more popular destination. The population increased, and in 1984, Brunswick County was forced to expand its courthouse. Holding true to the postmodern motif, it built a perplexing phallic-shaped annex that reminded many of a cancerous growth. Indeed, the locals referred to it as the tumor, as opposed to its official designation of the annex. 12 years later, as the population continued to grow, the county added a matching tumor at the opposite end of the new courthouse and declared itself ready for any and all business. The county seat was the town of Sterling. Brunswick and two adjoining counties comprised Florida's 24th Judicial District. Of the two circuit court judges, Claudia McDover was the only one headquartered in Sterling. Thus, she pretty much ruled the courthouse. She had seniority and clout, and all county employees walked softly around her. Her spacious office was on the third floor, where she enjoyed a pleasant view and some sunlight from one of the few windows. She despised the building and often dreamed of ways to acquire enough power to tear it down and start over. But that was just a dream. After a quiet day at her desk, she informed her secretary that she would be leaving at 4, an early exit for her. Her timid and well-trained secretary absorbed this information but asked no questions. No one asked Claudia McDover why she did anything. She left Sterling in her late model Lexus and took a county road south. 20 minutes later, she turned into the grand entryway of Treasure Key, a place she privately considered her casino. She was convinced that it would not exist but for her efforts. She had the power to shut it down tomorrow if she wanted. That, though, would not be happening. She took the periphery road along the edge of the property and smiled, as always, at the crowded parking lots, the busy shuttles running gamblers to and from their hotels, the gaudy neon billboards advertising shows by washed-up country crooners and cheap circus acts. All of it made her smile because it meant the Indians were prospering. People had jobs. People were having fun. Families were on vacation. Treasure Key was a wonderful place. And the fact that she was siphoning only a small piece of the action bothered her not in the least. Nothing bothered Claudia McDover these days. After 17 years on the bench, her reputation was sound, her job secure, her ratings high. After 11 years of sharing in the casino's profits, she was an incredibly rich woman, with assets hidden around the world and more piling up by the month. And though she was in business with people she didn't like, their swindling conspiracy was impervious to the outside world. There was no trail, no evidence. It had, after all, clicked right along for 11 years, since the day the casino opened. She passed through a gate and entered the swanky golf course and residential development of Rabbit Run. She owned 4 condos there. Or at least she owned the offshore companies that owned them. One she kept for herself. The other 3 she leased through her attorney. Her unit on the 4th fairway was a 2-story fortress with reinforced doors and windows. Hurricane protection had been her reasoning years earlier when she beefed up the place. Inside a small bedroom, she had built a 10-by-10 vault with concrete walls and security against fire and theft. Inside the vault, she kept some portable assets. Cash, gold, jewelry. There were also a few items that didn't move so easily. 2 Picasso lithographs, an Egyptian urn that was 4,000 years old, a porcelain tea set from another dynasty, and a collection of rare first-edition novels from the 19th century. The bedroom door was hidden behind a swinging bookcase, so that a person walking through the condo would not know the room and the vault existed. But no one walked through the condo. An occasional guest might be invited to sit on the patio for a drink. But the condo was not about drinking, or visiting, or living. She opened the curtains and looked at the golf course. It was the dog days of August, the air hot and sticky, and the course was deserted. She filled a teapot with water and placed it on a burner. While it warmed, she made 2 phone calls, both to lawyers with cases pending in her court. At 5, on time, her guest arrived. They met on the first Wednesday of each month at 5 p.m. Occasionally, when she was out of the country, they changed the meeting dates. But that was rare. Their communication was always face-to-face, in her condo, where there was no threat of hidden wires or bugs or surveillance of any type. They used phones only once or twice a year. They kept things simple and never left a trail. They were safe. And had been from the beginning. But they still took no chances. Claudia sipped tea, and Vaughn enjoyed his vodka on ice. He had arrived with a brown satchel, which he had placed on the sofa, same as always. Inside the satchel were 25 stacks of $100 bills, each bound tightly by rubber bands, each of $10,000. The monthly skim was $500,000, and they split it equally, as far as she knew. For years, Claudia had wondered how much he really took from the Indians, and since he did the dirty work himself, she had no idea. Over time, though, she had become quite content with her hall. And why not? She did not know the details. How exactly was the cash set aside? How was it kept off the books and away from security and surveillance? Who cooked the books to hide the skin? Who inside the depths of the casino actually took the loot and secured it for Vaughn? Where did he go to get it? And who delivered it to him? How many on the inside were being bribed? She knew none of this. Nor did she know what he did with his share of the cash once it left the casino. They had never had such discussions. She did not know anything about his gang, nor did she want to know. She dealt only with Vaughn Dubose and occasionally Hank, his faithful assistant. Vaughn had found her 18 years earlier, when she was a bored, small-town lawyer struggling to make a decent living and still plotting revenge against her ex-husband. He had a grand plan for massive development that would be fueled by a casino on Indian land. But there was an old judge in the way. Get rid of the judge, and perhaps an obstructionist or two, and Vaughn would be free to start bulldozing. He offered to finance her campaign and do whatever was needed to get her elected. He was around 70, but could pass for 60. With his perpetual tan and colorful golf shirts, he could have been just another wealthy retiree living the good life in the Florida sun. He'd been through 2 divorces and had been single for years. After Claudia became a judge, he made a move, but she had no interest. He was about 15 years older, which was not that much, really, but there were simply no sparks. Then, at the age of 39, she had also been coming to grips with the reality that she preferred women over men. And she found him boring, to be truthful. He was uneducated, interested in nothing but fishing, golf, and building the next strip mall or golf course. And his dark side still frightened her. Over the years, as rumors circulated and details emerged and the appellate courts raised questions, Claudia had begun to doubt that Junior Mace had in fact killed his wife and son Roscoe. Before and during the trial, she had been convinced of his guilt and wanted to deliver the right verdict for the voters who had just elected her. But with time and experience, she had developed serious doubts about his guilt. As the trial judge, though, her job had long been finished, and there was little she could do to right a wrong. And why should she? Son and Junior were gone. The casino was built. Her life was good. But the reality was that if Junior didn't do it, then someone in Vaughn's gang had pumped 2 bullets into the heads of Son Roscoe and Eileen Mace. And someone had arranged the disappearances of the 2 jailhouse snitches who had nailed Junior. Though Claudia maintained a facade of ball-squeezing bravado, she was deathly afraid of Dubose and his boys. In their one and only shouting match, now some 10 years in the past, she had convinced him that he would be immediately exposed if anything happened to her. Over the years, they had settled into a civilized relationship of mutual distrust, with each playing a well-defined role. She had the power to close the casino with an injunction for any half-baked reason, and had proven that she was unafraid to do so. He was in charge of the dirty work and kept the Tapacola in line. They prospered together, each getting richer by the month. It was amazing how much cordiality could be created and how much suspicion could be overlooked by truckloads of cash. They were sitting inside, in the cool air, sipping their drinks, watching the deserted fairway, smug in their schemes and incredible wealth. "How is North Dunes coming along?" she asked. "It's on track," he replied. "Zoning board meets next week and is expected to green light it. We should be moving dirt in 2 months. North Dunes was the latest addition to his golfing empire, with 36 holes, lakes and ponds, fancy condos, and even fancier mansions, all wrapped around a contrived business center with a town square and amphitheater, and only a mile from the beach. "The supervisors are in line?" she asked. A stupid question. The cash DuBose delivered to her was not the only bribe he spread around the county.
4-1, he said. Polly dissenting, of course.
Why don't you get rid of him?
No, he's necessary. We can't make it look too easy. 4-1 works just fine.
Bribes really weren't necessary in their part of the country. Take any form of growth, from high-end gated communities to low-end shopping centers. Fix up a slick brochure filled with half-truths. Label it economic development with the promise of tax revenue and jobs. And elected officials reached for their rubber stamps. If anyone mentioned environmental issues, or traffic, or crowded schools, they were dismissed as liberals or tree-huggers, or, much worse, northerners. Vaughn had mastered the game years ago.
"And the EC?" she asked. "Extra condo."
"Of course, Your Honor. Golf course or high-rise?"
"How tall is the high-rise?"
"How tall would you like it?"
"I'd like to see the ocean. Is that possible?"
"No problem. It's a 10-story building as of now, and from halfway up, the Gulf will soon be visible on a clear day."
"I like that. Ocean view. Not the penthouse, but something close." The idea of an extra unit had been perfected by a legendary Florida developer nicknamed Condo Conroy. In the rush and fury of throwing up an oceanside tower, plans were modified on the fly, walls moved here and there, and the result was an extra condo the zoning board knew nothing about. It could be used for a dozen purposes, none of which were exactly legal. Vaughn had learned the trick, and his favorite judge had accumulated an impressive portfolio of ECs over the years. Her balance sheet also included slices of legitimate businesses. A shopping mall, a water park, 2 restaurants, some small hotels, and a lot of raw land just waiting to be bulldozed.
"Another drink?" she asked. "There are 2 things we need to discuss."
"I'll get it."
He stood and walked to the kitchen counter where she kept the hard booze, stuff she never touched. He poured a shot, added 2 cubes of ice, and returned to his seat.
"I'm listening."
She took a deep breath because this would not be easy. "Wilson Van Gogh."
"What about him?"
DuBose snapped. "Just listen. He's served 14 years and his health is very poor. He has emphysema, hepatitis, and some mental problems. He's survived a number of beatings and other assaults, and there appears to be some brain damage."
"Good."
"He'll be eligible for parole in 3 years. Now his wife is dying of ovarian cancer, the family is destitute, and so on. A horrible situation. Anyway, someone got to the governor, and he wants to commute the rest of Van Gogh's sentence. But only if I agree."
Vaughn's eyes flashed hot, and he set his drink down. He pointed an angry finger at her and said,
"That son of a bitch stole $40,000 from one of my companies. I want him to die in prison, preferably after another assault. You understand, Claudia?"
"Come on, Vaughn. I gave him the max because of you. He served long enough. Poor guy is dying, so is his wife. Ease up."
"Never, Claudia. I never ease up. He's lucky he got prison and not a hole in the head." "Hell no, Claudia. Van Gogh does not get out."
Okay. Fix another drink. Settle down. Relax.
I'm fine. What else is on your mind?
She took a sip of tea and let a minute pass. When the air was somewhat lighter, she said,
Look, Vaughn, I'm 56 years old. I've been wearing the robe for 17 years, and I'm getting tired of the job. This is my third term, and with no opposition next year, I'm guaranteed 24 years on the bench. That's enough. Phyllis is planning to retire, too, and we want to travel the world. I'm tired of Sterling, Florida, and she's tired of Mobile. We have no kids to keep us grounded, so why not take off somewhere? Spend some of our Indian money.
She paused and watched him.
Your reaction? I like things the way they are, obviously. The great thing about you, Claudia, is that you were so easy to corrupt, and once corrupted, you fell hopelessly in love with the money. Same as me. The difference is that I was born into corruption. It's in my DNA. I'd rather steal money than earn it. You, on the other hand, were pure. But the ease of your conversion to the dark side was astonishing.
I wasn't pure. I was driven by hatred and a burning desire to humiliate my ex-husband. I wanted revenge, and there's nothing pure about that.
My point is that I'm not sure I can find another judge so eager to be purchased.
Do you really need one at this point?
If I leave, the casino loot is all yours. Not a bad little safety net. You own the politicians. You've bulldozed half the county, and there's plenty of sprawl in your pipeline. It's pretty obvious, at least to me, that you'll do just fine without a judge on the payroll. I'm just tired of work. And to be honest, which is not the right word to use in a conversation between us, I want to go straight for a while. With money or sex?
Money, you ass, she said with a chuckle. Vaughn smiled and sipped his vodka as the wheels turned. He was quietly thrilled at the idea. One less mouth to feed, and a big one.
We'll survive, he said.
Of course you will. My decision has not been made, but I wanted you to know what I'm thinking. I'm really tired of refereeing divorces and sending kids to prison for life. And I haven't told anyone but Phyllis.
You can trust me with your darkest secrets, Your Honor.
Thick as thieves. Vaughn stood and said,
I need to go. Same time next month?
Yes. On the way out, he picked up an empty leather satchel, an identical match to the one he'd brought in, though somewhat lighter. Chapter 7. The intermediary's name was Cooley, a former lawyer himself, though his exit from the profession was far less spectacular than that of his pal, Greg Myers. Cooley had managed to avoid headlines by quickly pleading to an indictment in Georgia and surrendering his license. He had no plans to try and get it back. They met in a quiet courtyard at the Pelican Hotel in South Beach, and over drinks on the small patio looked at the latest paperwork. The first few sheets summarized Claudia McDover's travel for the past 7 years, complete with dates, destinations, lengths of stay, and so on. The woman liked to travel and did so in style, usually by private jet, though none of the charters were booked in her name. Phyllis Turbin, her lawyer, handled the details and generally used one of two flight companies based in Mobile. At least once a month, Claudia drove to Pensacola or Panama City, boarded a small jet with Phyllis waiting, and took off to either New York or New Orleans for the weekend. There was no evidence of what they did on these trips, but the mole would have some ideas. Every summer, Claudia spent 2 weeks in Singapore and was believed to own a home there. For those longer trips, she traveled on American Airlines and flew first class. She went to Barbados at least 3 times a year by private jet. It was not clear whether Phyllis Turbin accompanied her on the trips to Singapore and Barbados, but the mall, using prepaid and untraceable cell phones, repeatedly called Turbin's office in Mobile and determined that she was not there when McDover was abroad. And the lawyer always returned to work when the judge did. In a memo, the mole wrote, "On the first Wednesday of each month, CM leaves the office a bit earlier than usual and drives to a condo in Rabbit Run. For some time, it was impossible to determine where she went. But once a GPS tracking device was attached to the inside of her rear bumper, her exact movements became known. The address of the condo is 1614 D Fairway Drive. According to the Brunswick County land records, the condo had changed hands twice and was now owned by a company registered in Belize. It is easy to speculate that she drives to the condo, receives a quantity of cash from the casino, then flies off with some or all of the money. Still speculating, the cash can be converted to gold, silver, diamonds, and collectibles. Certain dealers in New York and New Orleans are known to trade for cash, but for a stiff premium. Diamonds and jewelry are especially easy to smuggle out of the country. Cash can also be shipped by regular overnight parcel delivery to anywhere in the world, especially the Caribbean." Greg said, "I don't like all this speculating. How much does he really know?" Cooley replied, "Are you kidding? Look at the travel summary. Precise movements over a 7-year period. Plus, it sounds like this guy knows something about money laundering."
"Guy, as in male?"
"As in nothing. Neither male nor female as far as you're concerned."
"But he or she is my client."
"Knock it off, Greg. We have an understanding."
"To know this much, he must have daily contact with the judge. A secretary, maybe?"
"He or she told me once that McDover crushes secretaries. Fires them after a year or two. Stop guessing, okay? The mole is living in fear. Have you filed the complaint?"
"Yes. They are investigating now, and will slap it on the old gal in due course." "Talk about shit hitting the fan. Can you imagine the horror show when McDover realizes her party is over?"
"She won't panic, because she's too cold and too smart," Cooley said. "She'll call in her lawyers and they'll get to work. She'll call Dubose and he'll start his mischief."
"What about you, Greg? Your name is on the complaint. You're making the allegations." "My name will be hard to trace. Remember, I've never met McDover or Von Dubose. They don't know me from Adam. There are at least 1,800 Greg Myerses in this country, and all have addresses, phone numbers, families, and jobs. Dubose won't know where to start looking. Besides, if I see a shadow, I can haul ass in my little boat and become a speck in the ocean. He'll never find me. Why is the mole living in fear? His name will never be revealed."
"Gee, Greg, I don't know. Maybe he or she is unsophisticated in the world of organized criminal violence. Maybe he or she is worried that divulging too much dirt on McDover might lead back to him or her."
"Well, it's too late now," Greg said. "The complaint has been filed and the wheels are turning." "You gonna use this stuff anytime soon?"
Cooley asked, waving some papers.
"I don't know. I need some time to think. Let's say they can prove the judge likes to travel on private jets with her partner. Big deal. McDover's lawyers will just say there's no foul as long as Phyllis is footing the bill, and since Phyllis has no cases pending in McDover's court, where's the damage?"
Phyllis Turbin runs a small shop in Mobile, and her specialty is drawing up thick wills. I'll bet she nets $150 a year max. The jets they're using cost $3,000 an hour, and they're averaging 80 hours a year. Do the math.
That's a quarter of $1 million just in air charter fees. And that's just what we know about. As a circuit court judge, McDover's salary this year is $146,000. Together, they couldn't afford the jet fuel.
Phyllis Turbin is not under investigation. Maybe she should be. I really don't care. If we're going to make any money off this case, we have to nail a sitting judge.
Got it.
How often do you meet with the mole?
Myers asked.
Not very often. He or she is quite timid these days and scared to death. Then why is he or she doing this?
Hatred of McDover.
And money. I convinced our mole that this could lead to riches. I just hope I don't get anyone killed.
Lacey lived in a two-bedroom apartment in a converted warehouse near the Florida State campus and a 5-minute drive from her office. The architect who'd converted the building had done a fabulous job, and the 20 units had sold out quickly. Thanks to a loaded life insurance policy her father had maintained and her mother's generosity, Lacey had been able to make a sizable down payment on her place. She suspected it would be the only nice gift from her parents. Her father had been dead for 5 years, and her mother, Ann Stoltz, seemed to grow stingier as she grew older. She was pushing 70 and not aging as well as Lacey would have liked. Ann no longer drove more than 5 miles from her home, so their visits had become less frequent. Lacey's only companion was Frankie, her French bulldog. Since leaving for college at the age of 18, she had never lived with a man. Indeed, she had never been seriously tempted. A decade earlier, her one true love had begun hinting at cohabitation, but as she soon learned, he was already plotting to run away with a married woman, which he did in scandalous fashion. The truth was that at the age of 36, Lacey was content to live alone, to sleep in the center of the bed, to clean up only after herself, to make and spend her own money, to come and go as she pleased, to pursue her career without worrying about his, to plan her evenings with input from no one else, to cook or not to cook, and to have sole possession of the remote control. About a third of her girlfriends were young divorcees, all scarred and wounded and wanting no part of another man, not for the moment, anyway. Another third were stuck in bad marriages with little hope of getting out. And the rest of her girlfriends were content with their relationships, and either pursuing careers or having children. She didn't like the math. Nor did she like society's way of presuming she was unhappy because she had not found the right guy. Why should her life be determined by when and whom she married? She hated the assumption that she was lonely. If she'd never lived with a man, how could she miss one? And she was really tired of nosy inquiries from her family, especially her mother and her mother's sister, Aunt Trudy, neither of whom was capable of getting through a long conversation without asking if she was seeing anyone serious. "Who says I'm looking for anyone serious?" was her standard reply. She hated to admit it, but for the most part she preferred to avoid her mother and Trudy because of those conversations. Because she was happy and single and not prowling for Mr. Wright, they viewed her as a misfit. Someone to be pitied because she was drifting through life all alone. Her mother was a perpetually grieving widow, and Trudy had a dreadful husband. Yet they somehow considered their lives better. Oh, well. Part of being single was dealing with the misconceptions of others. She fixed another cup of green tea, caffeine-free, and thought about watching an old movie. But it was almost 10 and a week night, and she needed sleep. Sadell had emailed two of her latest memos, and Lacey decided to glance at one before she changed into her pajamas. For many years now, she had known that Sadell's memos were more effective than sleeping pills. The thinner memo was titled, Tapacola, Facts, Figures, Gossip. And it read,
Population. Not sure of the exact number of Tapacola Native Americans. By the way, the term Native American is a politically correct creation of clueless white people who feel better using it, when in reality, the Native Americans refer to themselves as Indians and snicker at those of us who don't. But I digress. According to the Bureau of Indian Affairs, the 2010 population was 441, up from 402 in 2000. But the bonanza reaped by the casino has put new pressure on the population, because, for the first time in history, so many more people seem desperate to become Tapacola. This is because of a distribution of wealth scheme commonly called dividends. According to statements made by Junior Mace, every Tapacola 18 or older gets a check for $5,000 a month. There is no way to verify this because, as in all matters, the tribe reports to no one. Once a woman marries, her monthly dividend is mysteriously cut in half. Dividends vary greatly from tribe to tribe, from state to state. Years ago, a tribe in Minnesota gained notoriety because its casino, which was grossing almost $1 billion a year, was owned by only 85 members. The annual dividend to each member topped $1 million. This is believed to still be the record. There are 562 recognized tribes in the U.S., but only about 200 operate casinos. There are approximately 150 additional tribes seeking recognition, but the feds have grown suspicious. New tribes face an uphill battle getting recognized. Many critics claim their sudden pride in their heritage is driven solely by the desire to get into the casino business. Most Indians do not share in these riches, and many still live in poverty. At any rate, like most tribes, the Tapacola have been inundated with folks claiming to be relatives. The dream of dividends has prompted this. The tribe has a committee that investigates and determines bloodlines. Anything less than being 1/8 Tapacola disqualifies the applicant. This has led to a lot of friction. It appears as though friction is not unusual with the tribe. According to a story 7 years ago in the Pensacola News Journal, the tribe holds an election every 4 years to elect a new chief and council. There are 10 council seats. Evidently, the chief has considerable power over all tribal matters, especially the casino. It must be an important position because the salary at that time was $350,000 a year. Also, the chief is given wide latitude in employment matters and usually loads up the administration with family members, all of whom earn nice salaries. Therefore, the elections are hotly contested, bitter, and full of accusations of ballot stuffing and intimidation. Must have learned this from us non-natives. It's sort of a winner-take-all scenario. The current chief is Elias Capel. By the way, very few modern-day Indians use the colorful names from the old days. At some point in history, most of them adopted Western names. Chief Capel was elected in 2005. And re-elected handily 4 years later. His son, Billy, sits on the council. The tribe has used its money wisely, having built state-of-the-art schools, a free medical facility that appears to be more like a clinic than a hospital, recreational facilities, daycare centers, roads, and most things good government provides. If a high school graduate wants to go to college, there is a fund to cover tuition to an in-state school, along with room and board. The tribe is also pouring more money into alcohol and drug prevention and treatment. As a sovereign nation, the Tapacola make and enforce their own laws, with no real regard for outside interference. The tribe has a constable who operates much like a county sheriff, and a full force of cops, all apparently well-trained and equipped. It has a beefed-up drug enforcement unit. Tight-lipped as they are, the chief and a few council members apparently don't mind divulging facts that tend to favor them, strong law enforcement being one of their favorite topics. They have a tribal court consisting of 3 judges to deal with disputes and wrongdoing. The judges are appointed by the chief and approved by the council. There is, of course, a jail and a correctional facility for long-term offenders. The Tapakola do an effective job of keeping their disputes and controversies contained. For years, the Pensacola News Journal, and to a lesser extent, the Tallahassee Democrat, have been snooping around looking for dirt, really just trying to find out how much money the tribe was making and which faction had the upper hand. Both newspapers have learned little. Evidently, the Tapakola are a closed-mouth bunch of folks.
Though somewhat interesting, the memo worked its magic and Lacey began yawning. She changed into pajamas and went through her nightly rituals in the bathroom, with the door open, once again thankful that she was alone with no one to bother her. Just before 11 p.m., she was almost asleep when the phone rang. It was Hugo, sounding as tired as ever. "This can't be good," she said.
"No, look, we need some help tonight. Verna's dead on her feet. I'm not much better. Pippin is at full throttle and the whole house is wired. We gotta get some sleep. Verna doesn't want my mother over here and I don't want hers. How about a big favor?"
"Sure, I'm on the way." It was the third time since the newborn's arrival that Lacey had been called in for midnight duty. She had kept the 4 kids on several occasions so Hugo and Verna could enjoy a quiet dinner, but only twice had she slept over. She dressed quickly in jeans and a t-shirt and left Frankie at the door, obviously confused. She hurried through the empty streets to the meadows and arrived at the Hatch home 20 minutes after the phone call. Verna met her at the door with Pippin, who was quiet for the moment.
"It's got to be a stomach ache," she whispered. "She's been to the doctor 3 times this week. Kid just can't seem to sleep."
"Where are the bottles?" Lacey asked, gingerly taking the baby from her mother.
"On the coffee table. The house is a wreck. I'm so sorry."
Her lip quivered and her eyes watered.
"Come on, Verna. It's me.
Go to bed and get some sleep. Things will be better in the morning." Verna pecked her on the cheek and said,
"Thank you."
She disappeared into the hallway. Lacey heard a door close quietly. She squeezed Pippin and began walking back and forth across the cluttered den, humming gently and patting her on the rear. Everything was quiet, but the lull didn't last. When she erupted again, Lacey stuck a bottle in her mouth and settled into a rocking chair, cooing at her non-stop until she finally drifted away. Half an hour later, with the baby in a deep sleep, Lacey placed her in a portable rocking crib and turned on the switch for a quiet lullaby. Pippin frowned and fidgeted a bit, and for a moment seemed ready for another round of noise, but then relaxed and continued her nap. After some time, Lacey left the baby and tiptoed into the kitchen, where she turned on the overhead light and was startled at the chaos. The sink was filled with dirty dishes. The counters were covered with pots and pans and food that needed to be put away. The table was strewn with empty snack boxes, backpacks, and even unfolded laundry. The kitchen needed a good scrubbing, but a proper job would be too noisy. She decided to wait until daybreak, when the family was stirring. She turned off the kitchen light, and in one of those delightful moments that she could share with no one, smiled and thanked her good fortune at being single and so wonderfully unburdened. She made a nest on the sofa near the baby, and eventually fell asleep. Pippin awoke hungry and angry at 3:15, but a bottle thrust firmly into her mouth did the trick. Lacey changed her diaper, cooed and cajoled her into another nap, and slept until almost 6 o'clock. Chapter 8. Wilton Mace lived in a red brick split level on a gravel road 2 miles from the casino. On the phone, he'd been reluctant to talk and said he would have to check with his brother. He called Hugo back the following day and agreed to a meeting. He was waiting in a lawn chair under a tree by the carport, swatting flies and drinking iced tea. The day was cloudy and not as hot. He offered Lacey and Hugo sweet tea to drink, and they declined. He pointed to 2 other folding chairs, and they sat down. A toddler in a diaper was playing in a plastic wading pool in the backyard, under the watchful eye of its grandmother. Wilton was 3 years younger than Junior and could almost pass for his identical twin. Dark skin, even darker eyes, long gray hair almost to his shoulders. He spoke with a deep voice, and, like Junior, seemed to weigh every syllable. "Is that your grandson?" Lacey asked, trying to break the ice, because Wilton showed no interest in doing so.
"Granddaughter. The first one. That's my wife, Nell. We met with Junior last week at Stark," Hugo said. "Thank you for going to see him. I make the trip twice a month, and I know it's not the best way to spend the day. Junior has been forgotten by his people, and that's tough on a man, especially one as proud as Junior."
"He said that most Tepecola believe he killed his wife and son Roscoe," Lacey said. He nodded for a long time, then said,
"That's true. It's a good story. Easy to repeat, easy to believe. He caught him in bed and shot him." "Can we assume you've talked to him since we were there?" Hugo asked. "I called him yesterday. He gets 20 minutes a day on the phone. He told me what you're up to."
"He said you tried to get a job at the casino, but it didn't happen. Can you explain that?"
Lacey asked. "It's simple. The tribe is split down the middle with both sides entrenched. Goes back to the vote on gambling. The winners built the casino and their chief runs everything, including the hiring and firing. Me, I was on the wrong side, so I couldn't get a job. It takes 2,000 people to run the casino, and most of them are from the outside. The Tapacola who want to work must have their politics right to get a job there." "So feelings are still pretty raw?" Hugo asked.
Wilton grunted and smiled.
"We may as well be 2 tribes, and blood enemies at that. There's been no effort at reconciliation. No one wants it, really."
Lacey said, "Junior says he and son were wrong to fight the casino because it's been good for the tribe. You agree?" Another long pause as he arranged his thoughts. His granddaughter began crying and was taken inside. He took a sip of tea and finally said,
"It's always hard to admit you're wrong, but I suppose we were. The casino has lifted us out of poverty and given us nice things, so that's a positive. A big one. We are healthier, happier, secure. There's a certain satisfaction in watching outsiders flock in here and hand us their cash. We feel like we're finally getting something back, perhaps a bit of revenge. Some of us worry, though, about living a life that's so grounded on handouts. Idleness leads to trouble. We're seeing more alcohol. Our kids are using more drugs."
Hugo asked,
"If life is more prosperous, why aren't there more children?" "Stupidity. The council is dominated by idiots, and they make bad rules. When a woman turns 18, she is entitled to the monthly check, which has been $5,000 for many years now. But if she marries, then it's cut in half. I get $5,000, my wife gets $2,500. So, more and more of our young women frown on marriage. The men are drinking and causing trouble, so why bother with a husband when you get more money without one? There is also the theory that a reduction in our population means larger checks for those who survive. Another bad plan. You have to invest in children for a healthy society.
Lacey glanced at Hugo and said, "We should talk about McDover."
"I know a little about the judge," Wilton said. "I sat through the trial and thought she was too young and too inexperienced. She did nothing to protect the rights of my brother. She has been attacked on appeal, but her rulings have been upheld, often by the thinnest of margins."
"You've read the appeals?" Hugo asked.
"I've read everything, Mr. Hatch. Many times. My brother is facing death for crimes he did not commit. The least I can do is sweat the details and support him. And obviously, I do have plenty of time."
"Was Son Roscoe having an affair with Junior's wife?" Hugo asked.
"Highly unlikely. Though, as you know, when it comes to that type of behavior, anything can happen. Son was a man of principle and morals, and he was happily married. I have never believed he was carrying on with my sister-in-law."
"So who killed them?"
"I do not know. Not long after the casino opened, we began receiving our slice of the pie, though in smaller amounts. At the time, I was a truck driver. Non-union, of course. And with my salary, my wife's wages as a cook, plus our dividend checks, we were able to save $25,000. I gave the money to a private investigator in Pensacola. He was supposed to be one of the best. He dug for the better part of a year and found nothing. My brother had a terrible lawyer at trial, a clueless kid who didn't know his way around the courtroom. But he's had some fine lawyers on appeal. They've been digging, too, for many years, and they've found nothing. I cannot give you the name of a likely suspect, Mr. Hatch. I wish I could. My brother was framed in a perfect setup, and it looks like the state of Florida will eventually kill him."
"Do you know a man named Von DuBose?" Lacey asked.
"I've heard the name, but never met the man."
"What's the reputation?"
Wilton rattled the ice cubes in his glass and suddenly looked tired.
Lacey felt sorry for him and tried to imagine the weight of having a sibling on death row, especially one believed to be innocent.
He finally said,
"There was once a legend around here that a big-time crook named DuBose masterminded all of this. The casino, the developments around it, the rapid sprawl from here to the coast. The legend extended to the murders of Son and Eileen. But it's all faded now, washed away in a tide of fun and games and cash and jackpots and water slides and happy hours, not to mention the welfare state. It doesn't matter now, because life is good. If the man really exists and has his finger in the pie, no one cares. No one wants to cause him any trouble. If he walked through the front door of the casino and told the truth, he would be worshipped like a hero. He made it happen."
"What do you believe?"
"What I believe doesn't matter, Mr. Hatch."
"Okay, it doesn't matter, but I'm still curious."
"All right. Yes, there was an organized criminal element involved with the construction of the casino. And these guys, nameless and faceless, are still taking a cut. They use guns, and they have thoroughly intimidated our chief and his cronies.
Lacey asked. What are our chances of finding someone from inside the casino who'll talk to us? He actually laughed, and when the moment passed, he mumbled,
You just don't understand.
He rattled his ice again and seemed to fixate on something across the road. Lacey and Hugo glanced at each other and waited. After a long gap, he said,
As a tribe, a people, a race, we don't trust outsiders. We don't talk. Sure, I'm sitting here talking to you, but the subjects are general in nature. We don't tell secrets. Not to anyone. Not under any circumstances. It's just not in our blood. I despise my people who are on the other side. But I would never tell you anything about them.
Lacey said, Perhaps a disgruntled employee, someone without your discretion. With all of this division and distrust, there must be a few people who are unhappy with the chief and his cronies.
There are some people who hate the chief. But bear in mind, he got 70% of the vote in the last election. His inner circle is tight. They all have fingers in the pie, and everyone is happy. It would be virtually impossible to find a snitch from within.
He paused and went silent. They endured another long gap, one that seemed not to bother him at all. Finally, he said,
And I would advise you to stay away from it. If Judge McDover is in with the crooks, then she's well protected by some boys who like violence and intimidation. This is Indian land. Ms. Stoltz, and all the rules that govern an orderly society, all the things you believe in, simply don't apply here. We govern ourselves. We make the laws. Neither the state of Florida nor the federal government has much to say in what we do, especially when it comes to running the casino.
They left him after an hour, after learning nothing that might help them. Other than the warning, and returned to the Tapakola Tollway, the busy four-lane the country had built to rake off a few bucks. Near the entrance to the reservation, they stopped at a booth and paid $5 for the privilege of proceeding. Hugo said,
I suppose this is the spot where Judge McDover decided to stop the traffic with her injunction.
Have you read that case? Lacey asked as she accelerated.
I read Sedell's summary. The judge claimed the traffic was a threat to public health and blocked the road with deputies for 6 days. 2001, 10 years ago.
Can you imagine the conversations between her and Von DuBose?
She's lucky she didn't catch a bullet.
No, she's too smart for that. So is DuBose. They managed to find common ground, and the injunction was lifted. Immediately past the booth, they were greeted with gaudy signs telling them that they were now on Tapakola land. Other signs pointed the way to Rabbit Run, and in the distance, there were waves of condos and homes lining fairways. Its property line was adjacent to the reservation, and as Greg Myers had said, a person could walk from the golf shop to the casino in 5 minutes. On a map, the Tapakola property had more bends and jags than a carefully gerrymandered congressional district. DuBose and company had gobbled up most of the property around it. And someone, probably DuBose himself, had picked the casino site as close to his land as possible. It was brilliant. They rounded a sweeping curve, and the massive casino was before them, its soaring entrance in the center awash with neon and swirling spotlights. It was anchored on each end with matching high-rise hotels. They parked in a crowded lot and caught a shuttle to the front, where they split and roamed the gaming floors for an hour. They met at 4 p.m. for coffee in a bar overlooking the craps and blackjack tables and watched the action. With the piped-in music,
The constant jangle of slot machines dumping coins onto the winners. The roar of voices at a hot craps table and the boisterous sounds of people drinking too much. It was obvious that some serious cash was